From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Mohammed Mehdi says he was born in Baghdad, but reborn in Berkeley. As Secretary General of the National Council on Islamic Affairs, Mehdi spends his days explaining Islam to Americans and explaining America to the leaders of the Mideast. On this edition of Fresh Air, Mohammed Mehdi tells us about his life in two worlds. Also today, Martin Sheen talks with us about starring in one of the best-known movies about the war in Vietnam, Apocalypse Now. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Smile of the Lamb, a new novel by Israeli writer David Grossman about the Israelis and the Palestinians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that he's sending Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and General Colin Powell to the Persian Gulf this week for a first-hand report on the war. The president said he wants his top military men to assess the effect of the air war and help him determine whether a ground assault is needed to drive Iraqi troops from Kuwait. Military officials in Saudi Arabia said today that more than 2,800 sorties were flown against the Iraqis, in addition to shelling from the battleship Missouri. American military officials say that 10 more Iraqi planes have eluded Allied air patrols and flown to Iran. NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Military sources say the latest batch of Iraqi aircraft include a number of French F-1 Mirage fighter bombers and at least two cargo planes. That brings to 110 the number of Iraqi planes now in Iran. U.S. military spokesman Major General Robert Johnston said the Iraqi planes are making a dash into Iran when their radars detect no Allied air patrols in the vicinity. Also, U.S. military officials announced the USS Missouri had fired its 16-inch guns in battle for the second time, damaging two Silkworm missile launchers, an artillery battery, and a radar control site. Saudi Arabian military officials announced the arrest of six suspects in connection with a shooting on a commuter bus Monday. Two American servicemen and one Saudi security guard were reportedly injured in that incident. I'm Deborah Wong in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
As the war in the Gulf continues, normally tranquil Jordan is beginning to experience more acts of anti-American terrorism. NPR's John Burnett reports.
In the latest attack, someone dumped gasoline on the car of a U.S. Embassy military attaché in Amman and set it ablaze. No one was hurt, but it's another in a series of relatively minor incidents aimed at the Western countries that make up the multinational alliance. Last week, an arsonist set the library of the French Cultural Center on fire, and the passing car threw a hand grenade in front of the British Bank of the Middle East. No one was hurt in either attack, and unknown pro-Iraqi groups took credit. The anti-Western atmosphere prompted the U.S. Embassy to send home all but a skeleton staff on Monday. Western banks, embassies, airlines, and major hotels have also sharply increased security. In Amman, I'm John Burnett.
The Bush administration presented Congress today with proposals for extensive changes in the way Americans bank and save. The plan was developed to help deal with a wave of bank and thrift failures. It's said to be the most comprehensive restructuring of the financial system in more than 50 years. The proposals would cut back on federal deposit insurance and repeal laws that bar ownership of banks by other industries, including insurance companies and securities brokers. Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady said the proposals are meant to modernize the financial system and streamline bank regulation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 16 points today to close at 2,788. This is NPR. Military officials in Colombia said that rebels staged attacks today around the country, timed to coincide with the opening of the country's new constitutional assembly. The military claimed that rebels killed 15 people, burned a number of vehicles, and dynamited electrical towers. The spokesman claimed the attacks were designed to draw attention away from the assembly that's been formed to rewrite Colombia's 100-year-old constitution. Israeli jet fighters attacked Palestinian guerrillas and allied pro-Iraqi Lebanese militiamen in South Lebanon today. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Tel Aviv.
The attacks began this morning as Israeli Air Force jets attacked high ground positions held by Palestinian commandos from Fatah, the majority faction of the PLO. Israel blamed Fatah for rocket attacks against Israel's northern border last week. The rocket attacks caused no damage or injuries, but they provided an opportunity to demonstrate to the Palestinians that Israel has no restraint policy, apparently, in southern Lebanon, as has been demonstrated against Iraq. even though Iraqi missiles have landed in Tel Aviv and killed or injured scores of people. Today's attacks by Israel in southern Lebanon killed at least 7 people and injured 12, although that figure was said to be low by southern Lebanon sources today. The attacks come at a time when a wide range of Lebanese groups have been calling for Palestinians to cease attacking Israel. Syria, which has an occupation force in Lebanon, wants to avoid fighting in the south against Israel while it remains part of the anti-Iraq coalition in the Gulf. This is John Hockenberry in Tel Aviv.
Israeli police said today that they've arrested 10 Israeli Arabs on charges of spying for Iraq. The Arabs were reportedly arrested over the past 2 weeks in northern Israel. The suspects are accused of photographing strategic sites and passing information to Baghdad on where Iraqi missiles have struck in Israel. The police said the Arabs were suspected of being recruited by the PLO's Fatah group. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Mohammed Mehdi has given himself the mission of trying to explain the Islamic world to the West and the West to the Islamic world. He's the Secretary General of the National Council on Islamic Affairs in New York and the President of the American Arab Relations Committee. Mehdi is a hybrid of two cultures. He grew up in Baghdad, but has lived in the U.S. for more than 40 years and is an expert in American constitutional law. He's the author of several books, including Constitutionalism, Western and Middle Eastern, A Peace in the Middle East, and Islam and Intolerance, A Reply to Salman Rushdie. I spoke with Mehdi earlier today and asked him if this war was a terrible setback to his goal of explaining the Islamic world to the West.
Well, it is an ugly development, not only for Islam, but for the human cause, for the cause of peace, for the American people. I have stated that we are caught between a madman in Baghdad, Iraq, and a madman in Washington, D.C. And regretfully, our own madman in Washington is a greater danger to America's economy, social fabric, its international standing, to civility, than Saddam Hussein could ever be a threat to America. And it really breaks my heart that this height of modern Western civilization is engaged in destroying the cradle of human civilization, Baghdad, which is my hometown. Baghdad, the city of chemistry, physics, agronomy, modern science, today being destroyed by the most advanced civilization. The future historians, when they write, the barbarians of the 20th century destroyed the cradle of human civilization.
What position has your group taken on the war?
Well, we have denounced Saddam. Saddam, I have opposed him for the last 10, 15 years for a number of reasons. We have felt that his oppression at home was a violation of our hopes for the democratization process in Iraq. His war against Iran was condemned. His invasion of Kuwait was condemned, and we believe that he should get out of Kuwait. But what President Bush has been doing is more damaging America's future in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, in the Third World. And even though the news media have so far not reported the reaction of the Third World against American action, we will hear more about attacks on American embassies, American business establishments, American civilians traveling, because the Americans really do not understand the unbelievable thing that Bush is doing.
You know Saddam Hussein personally. How did you get to know him?
Oh, whenever I go to the Middle East, I meet with all the Arab kings, presidents, because while in this country, we try to interpret the Arab and Muslim thinking to the American people, when we visit the Middle East, we try to interpret the American institutions to the Arab and Muslim rulers, kings, news media. We hope that we are a link. And in that capacity, when I went to the Middle East several times, I met with Saddam, as I have met with Yasser Arafat, Gaddafi, King Fahd, King Hussein. And these guys are really not that important, not that big. What makes them important is American foreign policy. When President Reagan was picking on Gaddafi, the head of a 3 million country, then Gaddafi developed an international stature. Not that Gaddafi was so big, but Reagan made him big. Today, America's attack on Saddam is making Saddam the greatest hero throughout the Arab and Muslim world, not because Saddam has become a nice guy, but because he is standing tall against what is conceived in the Arab and Muslim and Third World as a continuation of Western colonial aggression. And of course, Saddam stands tall because he is opposed to Western colonialism coming into the area again in the name of what Bush says, New World Order. But the New World Order is understood by the Third World people as a new form of Western colonialism.
Mohammed Mehdi is my guest. He's the Secretary General of the National Council on Islamic Affairs in New York and President of the American Arab Relations Committee. Now, I want to ask you a few things about yourself. I know you have your doctorate from the University of California at Berkeley in political science, specializing in American constitutional law. That's very interesting to me because I think one of the fundamental differences between Islam and Judeo-Christian culture is that in Islam there's no separation between, you know, church and state, between the religious and the secular. So tell me how you came to study constitutional law.
Terry, because I was a fortunate man. I was born in Baghdad and reborn in Berkeley. I consider my education at the University of California as a rebirth. So I was born in Baghdad, reborn in Berkeley. When you say that the difference, the basic difference between Islam and the Judeo-Christian tradition, which Judeo-Christian tradition of prior to the Reformation wars or after Reformation war? Because this separation between religion and the state in the West evolved after some 200 years of revolution and the wars of Reformation, in which hundreds of thousands of Catholics were killed by hundreds of thousands of Protestants, and the Catholics reciprocated in killing Protestants, and all of them killed and gassed Jews. So the separation did not come about, was not part of the original Christianity, original Judaism. It evolved as a result of painful 200 years of war. Happily or unhappily, Islam has not had its reformation. That is why there is a greater link between religion and state in the Muslim lands than in the West. And in my opinion, as a student of these affairs, the Muslim world will have its reformation, but peacefully, without these hundreds of thousands getting killed on religious grounds, as took place in Europe.
You've written that tolerance is the hallmark of Islam. But for many of us in the West, when we look at Islam, we see in some countries a lack of tolerance for pluralism.
You are so an astute an observer, Terry. Islam is one thing, what the Muslims do, maybe something else. Like Christianity, the Prince of Peace, thou shalt not kill. Now, that is one thing, and the Christian Americans who dropped the A-bomb over Hiroshima, and in Vietnam, the Christian Americans killed more than 2.5 million poor people of that wretched land. These are not doing it in their Christian capacity as Christians, they are doing it in their political capacity. And so Islam is a religion of tolerance because, and by tolerance it means appreciation of differences. You are a Jew, fine with me. You are a Christian, fine with me. You are a Presbyterian, a Buddhist, fine with me, because we are all to be judged by God. Now, some Muslims, for political reasons, have become sexists, have become intolerant and against pluralism. It is the political circumstances, deviation from the spirit of Islam, And I'm sure if the Prophet was here, would condemn all these Muslims, just as if the Prince of Peace was here, he would condemn George Bush for his barbarian killing of the civilian people in Iraq.
You said that you were born in Baghdad and reborn in Berkeley. How did you feel that you were reborn in Berkeley?
Terry, I flew to Berkeley in 1949 as a 16th, 17th century person. I believe, for example, that God has created the government and the king represented government, very much similar to the thinking in Western Europe in 16th, 17th century, the divine theory of the kings, that the king Charles James represented God on earth. I came out to America with that mentality. At Berkeley, they told me, no, the government is the instrument of the will of the people, not established by God, but by the people. And I had to go through a painful experience, gradually chipping my beliefs, throwing them out under the rigorous logic and its impact. Gradually and painfully, I had to give up much of my dogmatic beliefs, simplistic moralist standards, to become part of the 20th century. So I spent in Berkeley some 300-400 years within 3-4 years. What a fortunate man.
Mohammed Mehdi is my guest. He's the Secretary General of the National Council on Islamic Affairs in New York and President of the American Arab Relations Committee. When you came to America, it was the late 1940s. You studied at Berkeley. And then you decided to stay in America, I suppose.
Yes. I came as a student on a scholarship by the government of Iraq to study, out of all things, they wanted me to study accounting, debit, credit, balance sheet, the boring thing that I just couldn't stand. So I gave it up. I changed into political science at Berkeley. We had some of the great, brilliant scholars in the political science department. And I was gradually involved and became in love with the beloved First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. This captured my imagination and the stress that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, not abridging the freedom of speech of the citizens, but it shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech of the human beings under the American jurisdiction. Wow, what a great difference between this open society and the closed societies of the Middle East, Asia, and Africa with which I had my experiences.
Is that why you decided to stay?
Well, this love affair, then it also developed a personal love affair. I fell in love. I had children. Then gradually my children, 3 beautiful daughters, who gradually became part of the American soil. They knew more about the Supremes and the monkeys and what more than I knew about Beethoven and Bach. So I felt gradually that if I go back, I really will be uprooting these people.
What kind of Islamic culture did you find in the States when you decided to stay here?
A very limited one. In those days, in 1949s, 50s, there were 3 mosques in the country, in Sacramento, California, one in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which was the first mosque built in this country, and one in Washington, D.C. By now, those 3 have become more than 1,500, and Islam is the second largest religion in the country. Some 9 to 10 million American Muslims. Great change in this country. And of course, the people who come here bring with them from the old country the feelings and the traditions, and gradually they will be exposed, as I was fortunately, to the thrills of the open society. And that is why I think that American Muslims are the most fortunate Muslims in the world, because here we have the freedom to think, to reevaluate, to reinterpret, And thereby, when American Muslims, we put our acts together, we can educate the Muslim in the old country and bring them back from their 18th, 19th century to the 21st century. We are a fortunate people.
My guest is Mohammed Mehdi, Secretary General of the National Council on Islamic Affairs in New York. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Mohammed Mehdi is my guest. He's the Secretary General of the National Council on Islamic Affairs in New York and President of the American Arab Relations Committee. What was your participation in trying to bring together Muslims from different parts of the world who had emigrated to the United States and to, you know, to form some kind of network or connection?
It really was a painful one, a lonely experience. We were 2-3 here at Berkeley. Occasionally there are 2-3 in Davis, California, which is the other UC campus there. And we meet on the occasions, we pray together, we engage in the festivities, celebrating Eid al-Adha or Eid al-Fitr. These are Islamic holidays. But it was a minute, and somehow we were trying to protect ourselves, defend ourselves, hide ourselves, fearful that the general, we may be ridiculed by the majority of the people. Now, in contrast to the earlier days, those painful, slow, frightening days, we are more part of the Americana, doing our two bits as any other people. When President Bush last week called upon the religious groups to pray, we also joined in praying for our armed forces in the Gulf, praying to God to bring them all back immediately, fast, without killing any further or getting killed.
Is the war directly affecting the way you think you are being perceived as an Arab American or your friends or family? I'm wondering, like, directly in your life, if you felt any sense of discrimination.
Not much, even though in our offices we have been receiving some 25% telephone calls, which are nasty, obnoxious, threatening. And I walked the other day, I was on 3rd Avenue and 45th Street. A man calls me, "Dr. Mehdi, Dr. Mehdi." I look back. He had seen me on television the night before, and he gives me the peace sign, supporting our position. Then a few minutes later, a man calls, "Mehdi, Mehdi." I look back, and he gives me half of the peace sign. So we get to this is a part of the ups and downs of life. But I must say that all the bad things that we receive now compared with 10 or 20 years ago, 10 years ago, out of 100 calls, 90% of them were threatening. Now it is only 20% of them are threatening. It is a tribute to the open society and to the news media, which has educated the people.
Do you have family still in Baghdad?
Terry, I have families in Iraq. I have friends in Iraq. And when these bombs, today there were 400 aerial assaults upon Baghdad, dropping thousands of tons of bombs. It shatters me. It has made me feel, and I have expressed it on another network, like seeing my brother with his powerful muscles killing my mother. It is a painful experience, and for no good reason. If President Bush had waited 6 more months, I know the Saddam regime would have peacefully collapsed under the impact of the embargo and the sanctions. But Bush, being impatient, is afraid that he may be called a wimp, So he engages in this act, which is really, on the long run, more damaging to America. And it is easy for you to get into a hole. It is difficult to get out. U.S. went into Korea some 40 years ago. Still, U.S. is there in Japan. Still, U.S. is there in Europe. By the time the U.S. may get out of the Middle East and Asia and the Third World, maybe 40, 50 years from now.
Do you have any inside information on what life is like in Iraq now?
What we have received is that it is frightening. People are terrorized. And when the Americans talk about terrorism, that some guy shoots at somebody and that is an act of terrorism, it bothers me, because what America is engaged today is terrorizing a whole people. Yes, people are frightened. Every second they hear these huge bombers coming across their skies. They don't have food. They don't have water. This morning I received the information that in certain areas, people go to borrow from each other a cup of water, a glass of water. Food they don't have. Even water, they have to borrow it from each other. A miserable life, because George Bush has personalized this war against Saddam Hussein, and hundreds of thousands of people have to pay for it.
You've given us a sense of the kind of message you'd like to send to George Bush. Is there a message you wish you could send, or that you, in fact, have sent to heads of state in the Middle East on both sides?
I sure have. I have called upon Saddam to get out of Kuwait. But Saddam would not get out of Kuwait because of the American military force. He would get out of Kuwait, and we have advised the Arab and Muslim governments to take the initiative, to take the leadership, to pressure Saddam peacefully, persuade him to get out. And Saddam, as I know him, he would listen more to fellow Arabs, fellow Muslims, in their more peaceful persuasion than ever he would listen to this colonial bully from 8,000 miles away who has become the policeman of the world.
But they hadn't been very effective in trying to get him out of Kuwait.
My dear, complex things take longer time. Americans negotiated with the Russians 40 years. Russia was in a terrible colonial power, communist, all the nasty things. But what do? You negotiate 40 years. President Jimmy Carter negotiated with the Iranians 444 days. And in the Middle East, people may fight cats and dogs one day, and you see them the next day kissing and hugging. The style of solving problems there are other than the style in the West. But then what would Bush know about the psychology of modern nationalism? If he had not jumped in, I'm sure the people there, 6 months, a year, year and a half, would have gotten Saddam out of Kuwait peacefully.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, and thank your audiences.
Mohammed Mehdi is the Secretary General of the National Council on Islamic Affairs in New York and the President of the American Arab Relations Committee. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Members of the Sheen family have starred in the two best-known movies about the Vietnam War, Charlie Sheen in Platoon and Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. Coming up, Martin Sheen talks about making movies about war. Book critic John Leonard calls David Grossman Israel's best young writer. Coming up, John Leonard reviews The Smile of the Lamb, Grossman's novel about the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that he doubts Iraqi forces can be expelled from Kuwait without a ground war. Mr. Bush told a news conference that Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and General Colin Powell are going to the Persian Gulf later this week to bring back a first-hand status report. The president said in order to get a ceasefire in the Persian Gulf War, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein would have to undertake a visible and totally convincing pullout from Kuwait. U.S. and allied officials continued to report nothing but success today as Iraqi forces absorbed attacks by thousands of airstrikes and more naval bombardment as well. We have more from NPR's Neil Conan.
The battleship Missouri, firing its enormous 16-inch guns for the second day in a row, silenced an Iraqi artillery battery and destroyed an Iraqi radar station, and the U.S. Central Command claimed that Marine Harrier jets bombed and strafed a column of 25 Iraqi trucks. Major General Robert Johnston also said that a Cobra helicopter gunship found one Iraqi armored vehicle out in the open and destroyed it with a TOW missile. There were no U.S. losses reported Tuesday, and no Iraqi Scud missile attacks. U.S. commanders emphasized that Iraq had fired 35 of the Soviet-made missiles in the first week of Operation Desert Storm, 18 the second week, and just 4 over the past 6 days. Also, 10 more Iraqi aircraft reportedly flew to internment in Iran. That makes a total of 110, including many of Iraq's best fighters. This is Neil Conan reporting.
In Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev has issued a decree outlawing this Saturday's vote on independence in Lithuania. He has accused the Baltic Republic of trying to block the Kremlin's referendum on the future of the whole Soviet Union. Bridget Kendall of the BBC reports the Republic's leader has criticized this decree as interference in Lithuanian affairs.
Lithuanian leader Vytautas Landsbergis has already defended his Republic's right to run its own opinion polls without interference from Moscow. The question being asked of voters on Saturday is, do you agree that the Lithuanian state should be an independent and democratic republic? If, as the republic leaders believe, an overwhelming majority answer yes, they hope the result will be a strong propaganda weapon to demonstrate both to Moscow and to the rest of the world that Lithuania's independence is supported by its people. But the Soviet president didn't hide his annoyance that Lithuania has already declared it won't take part in a union-wide referendum in March on the future of the whole Soviet Union. And he accused the Vilnius leadership of using the opinion poll to back up separatist ambitions and block the March referendum. Soviet officials said the decree were to make sure plans to carry out that referendum were strictly observed.
Bridget Kendall in Moscow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 16 points. This is NPR News. U.S. military officials say that 10 more Iraqi airplanes have flown to Iran. There are now about 110 Iraqi airplanes in Iran. When questioned about how the Iraqis were able to evade Allied warplanes, a U.S. military spokesman in Saudi Arabia said that the Iraqis waited until there were gaps in air coverage, and then they slipped through. In Washington, President Bush announced today that the U.S. will open talks with Canada and Mexico in pursuit of a North American free trade agreement. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush says that after speaking today with Mexican President Carlos Salinas and Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, the three leaders agreed to seek a trilateral trade agreement to link the economies of all three countries. Mr. Bush says such an agreement would expand market opportunities and increase prosperity.
A free trade area encompassing all three countries would create a North American market of 360 million people with annual production of more than $6 trillion. This agreement would be a dramatic first step toward the realization of a hemispheric free trade zone, stretching from Point Barrow in Alaska to the Straits of Magellan.
The president did not say how soon the trade talks would get underway. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Also in Washington, the government said today that new orders for manufactured goods showed no change in the month of December, after falling close to 6% the month before. Shipments of manufactured goods dropped 3.4%. The Commerce Department says that most of the new orders in December were in defense-related goods and airplanes, and without these, new orders would have fallen 4.7%. Officials say that they are not aware of any terrorist links to six pipe bombs found yesterday on two chemical tanks near the Norfolk Naval Base in Virginia. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
Everyone gets everything he wants. I wanted a mission. And for my sins, they gave me one. Brought it up to me like room service.
Captain Willard, are you in there?
Yeah.
It was a real choice mission. And when it was over, I'd never want another.
In Apocalypse Now, Captain Willard, played by Martin Sheen, is sent on a mission deep into the Cambodian jungle. His job is to kill a fellow American, the renegade Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando. Sheen has returned to the military in his new film, Cadence, in which he's a hardened combat veteran who's the commander of a stockade. The only white prisoner in the stockade is played by Sheen's son, Charlie Sheen. Another son, Ramon Estevez, also appears in Cadence. This is Martin Sheen's first time out directing a feature film. Sheen's acting credits include starring roles in The Dead Zone, Badlands, and Wall Street. Cadence is based on a novel by Gordon Weaver.
It's a story about a young GI from Montana who's serving at a tiny base in West Germany when his father dies in 1965, and he goes home for the funeral, and he's crushed by the whole business, and he's an orphan now, so he wants out of the Army very badly. He goes back to his outfit and behaves very badly and ends up in the stockade for 3 months, and it turns out he's the only white guy in there. And this black community really has a very powerful effect on him, and he becomes a member of that family, and he's made whole and healthy by them.
I find it really interesting that two of the best-known Vietnam War films starred people in your family. Apocalypse Now starred you, Platoon starred your son, Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried to figure out, like, how that came to be? You know, it seems like such a bizarre coincidence.
I was amazed by it. After Platoon came out, I couldn't believe the similarities and the effects that it had on Charlie, and the similar effects, of course, that Apocalypse had had on me. We shared a lot in common. Just one of those remarkable coincidences.
Well, Apocalypse Now is a very difficult film for you in a lot of ways, and I know you suffered a heart attack while making it.
We're never going to forget that, are we?
Well, I was wondering, though, if you almost tried to warn your son Charlie against making Platoon because of the hardships that you suffered while making Apocalypse Now.
Well, it's not entirely for that reason. I, frankly, at the time, after reading the script, did not feel that it was that good.
Platoon?
Yeah. I felt he shouldn't do it, and thank heaven he didn't listen to me.
What didn't you like about the script?
Well, the script was much different than the movie, as most the scripts are, you know. It became a movie when Oliver did such a brilliant job on it. The script was more or less a map of the general area, but it was not as specific, not nearly as specific as the movie. And that's kind of typical about the way movies get done, from the time they leave the page until they end up as the final production.
Apocalypse Now was compared to the actual war in Vietnam, is in that as the filmmakers got into the movie, they got more and more mired into the movie, and the financial and human cost of the movie became greater than anyone had expected. Do you think that's a valid comparison? Did you feel that way during the making of the film?
Well, I did on a very much different kind of level. I felt, in a sense, that we had misbehaved very badly, and that a lot of the difficulties we had were from our misbehavior, the way we treated certain people at certain times. And I felt very ashamed about that, and I know a lot of my colleagues did as well. But there were a lot of logistical problems, a lot of weather problems, and things that could not have been foreseen in a budget or any kind of planning with this film. And but to say that it resembled any kind of way that the war was conducted, I don't think that's very accurate. I mean, we had like one or two boats, and nobody was really shooting at us, so that I think it's it's kind of a Hollywood comparison rather than a realistic one.
You referred to the misbehavior, feeling bad about how people were treated. What were you referring to?
Well, I was ashamed of the way some members of our company, mind you, we were a very large company, were treating the local people, the Filipino people, the Ifugao people. And I was embarrassed by this and tried to distance myself in some measure from my company.
What kind of emotional and physical demands were made on you during the making of the film?
Well, they weren't just on me. I mean, well, they were very heavy, of course, but it wasn't just me. It was everybody, and it was certainly members of my family and members of the company, particularly the actors, and Francis and his family. And the toll was heavy, you know. When I arrived in Manila in May of 77, I was prepared for a 16-week shoot, and that was it. And I ended up doing 13 months, and there were some that did a few months longer than I, because I came as a replacement. You know, they had been shooting for some few months before I got there.
Who did you replace?
A dear, sweet man. And later, we became friends. In fact, I've worked with him a couple of times. That's Harvey Keitel. Yeah, if I'd talked to him before I'd gone in, I may have changed my mind. But I have no regrets, absolutely none.
Did you feel that the movie had something to do with the heart attack?
Well, not really, because I think, in all honesty, I would have had that heart attack somewhere eventually. I nearly died, you know, and it changed my life. It led me back to the Catholic Church eventually in 1981. And the past 10 years have been by far the most difficult and equally the best years and the happiest years of my life.
One more question about Apocalypse. Can you tell us a little bit about the shooting of the opening scene?
The absolute truth about it was shot on my 36th birthday, August the 3rd, 1976, in a little town called Santa Cruz in the local City Hall, which we were using as a hotel. And I had been drinking all of that day, and I was quite inebriated by the time we got to filming that scene. And I asked Francis to allow me to wrestle, in a sense, with some demons that were inside of me that I was wrestling with for a number of years. And I thought this would be an opportunity, in a sense, to get them out in the open, to wrestle with them in public, to wrestle with them on film. And he was very reluctant, and particularly when I hurt myself in the middle of the scene, he tried to stop it. I slammed my hand into a mirror, which I didn't even know was there.
This is when you're practicing karate chops, right?
He tried to stop the scene. I said, no, please continue on. And he had two cameras going, and I begged him not to stop.
And you're referring to the part where you're kind of like practicing moves and karate chops, and you accidentally put your hand through the mirror.
Well, I was so inebriated, I could hardly stand up, you know, and I was very vulnerable, and a lot of my pain came to the surface. There was no defense left, and you saw really, in a sense, who I was at that time. I was a very confused man, very unhappy man. And I came to grips with it there.
So what do you see when you look back at that scene now?
Oh, dear, I haven't seen it in 12 years, I guess. I saw the picture when it opened, and I saw it once since. And I have not seen it since then.
Why not?
Oh, well, it's in the past, you know. I don't look over my shoulder very often. I think it's
it's dangerous because you can't see where you're going if you're looking behind you. So I've left that go and have gone on, you know. That's who I was, you know. That's where I was at that time. That's not who I am now or where I am now. And so I'm able to move on. I've exercised it, if you will.
Actor Martin Sheen is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Martin Sheen is my guest, and he stars in and directs the new movie Cadence, which also stars his son, Charlie Sheen. In 1989, you were the honorary mayor of Malibu, and you declared the city a nuclear-free zone, a sanctuary for aliens and homeless, and a protected environment for all life, wild and tame. Yeah. Did they get rid of you real quick after that?
You bet. Who could blame them?
So what happened?
Yes. I don't think they knew anything about me, you know. I was one of the people in the Chamber of Commerce called and said, well, will you do this? And I said, no, I'm not interested. And they said, well, it's just a honorary position, and it's just a figurehead kind of thing. I said, okay, let's go for it. And so I used the occasion of Dan Berrigan's birthday to make this announcement, and the old yogurt hit the fan, as they say. And Malibu hasn't been the same since, thank God.
You know what the trouble is about being an actor with quote, good politics? Now, tell me what you think here. When I was watching your movie Cadence, and the character played by your son, Charlie Sheen, who is white, gets thrown into a stockade with prisoners who are all black, and he realizes that he's bound to be the outsider in this community of all black, one white. You know, all the black characters in the stockade are charged with horrible crimes, rape and murder and so on. But you know that they're really going to be good people who were probably unjustly accused of their crimes, because you know that the director of this movie, Martin Sheen, has really good politics, and you know he's going to be making an anti-racist statement. So you could kind of guess what's going to happen in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what do you think?
So what? You know, how many pictures do you go to where Arnold or Sylvester isn't up to their old tricks, and you figured it out in the first frame. You figure it out from the advertisement, don't you? I mean, what's wrong with exploring who I am and what I do for a living? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so if people
I come from a place, and I stand for something different. And if in coming into a movie, you're going to be exposed to that, in my opinion, it's fair enough, you know, because it'll keep just as many people away. You follow? I mean, there's going to be a lot of folks that say, well, we know it's Sheen, we know that old radical, you know. He's going to be preaching the gospel of dissent and so forth, so we won't bother with his movie. And that's fair enough, too, you know.
You were born with the name Ramon Estevez.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how and why you changed your name to Martin Sheen?
Well, I didn't change it officially. My name is still Ramon Estevez. My son, Ramon Estevez, is in this movie with Charlie and I, as you know. And when I came to New York 32 years ago, it was very difficult to get anyone interested in me as an actor, let alone as a Hispanic actor with this name, which few people could even understand. So rather than change it, I chose another one, and I chose the name Martin Sheen. I chose the Martin from a dear man who was a casting director at CBS at the time, who was very encouraging to me. His name was Robert Dale Martin. And I chose the Sheen from a man who had a very powerful influence on me as well when I was a lad, and his name was Bishop Fulton J. Sheen. He was the auxiliary bishop of New York, and during the 50s, he used to have a television show, a half hour every Tuesday night on network TV, where he literally delivered a lecture, and he was very popular. And I thought of him as a wonderful actor. So I put those two names together, and I invented this character that's speaking to you now. But I have kept my name, Ramon Estevez, and it's still on all legal documents, including a passport and driver's license and so forth.
Do you have any feelings one way or another about your children who act using the Sheen name or the Estevez name? Because they've made both of those choices.
Well, I'm so proud of Emilio. He was the first one to jump in, and he kept his name, and he was really torn about it. And I said, oh, please, 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 keep your name. Keep your name. And he did. Charlie decided to change it, and I really, really tried to get him to use his name, and he felt it. He wanted to use Sheen. And it's fine, you know. He's entitled. He's an adult, and he lives with that, and it's fine, you know. But Ramon has kept it, and Renee has kept it. It's just a sense of Hispanic pride that I have that made me want them to keep the name.
Martin Sheen, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Martin Sheen stars in the new film Cadence, which he also directed. Here he is in Apocalypse Now.
Saigon. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm gonna wake up back in the jungle. I'm here a week now. Waiting for a mission. Getting softer. Every minute I stay in this room, I get weaker. And every minute Charlie squats in the bush, he gets stronger. Each time I looked around, the walls moved in a little tighter.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the Gulf War?
Well, we'll have news of the action reported by the Allied briefers today, and also another report on voices of the home front. Noah Adams' conversations with residents of Cleveland, Tennessee, today members of a support group for the families and friends of people who've either been sent over to the Gulf or have been called up for reserve duty to go to the Gulf. Also, news today of the Treasury Department's proposed reforms of the banking system, the most sweeping proposal for changing the way our banks operate in decades, and news of the campaign to come in California.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Israeli writer David Grossman is best known in the U.S. for his controversial 1988 book, The Yellow Wind. It was an account of his 3-month stay on the West Bank, how living among Palestinians and Jewish settlers there changed his perceptions. Grossman's second novel, Sea Under Love, published here 2 years ago, was an exploration of the Holocaust and its legacy. Now Grossman's first novel, The Smile of the Lamb, has been published here. He wrote it in 1983. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
If you are a student of literature, you will want to read David Grossman's first novel, The Smile of the Lamb, just to see where he came from before he wrote his masterpiece, Sea Under Love. If you are an orphan of contemporary history and politics, you will want to read The Smile of the Lamb to find out what this remarkable writer thinks has happened to the heart, the mind, and the soul of his nation during its military occupation of the West Bank and its treatment of the Palestinians. In either case, you'll discover something ambitious and awkward, splendid and bruised, a haunting hybrid of landscapes, cultures, and ideas. The message is simple enough. Israel says its best young writer, by oppressing another people and by lying about it in the mirror, has corrupted itself. One character, a poet with blood on his hands, explains it's as if some tormented Russian playwright cast us, of all people, in the role of conquerors and murderers, and the gun in Act One of our historic pageant is now shooting at us, and we hear the curtain going down, but no applause. The means and method of this message, however, are anything but simple. Meet Yuri, an idealistic young Sephardic Jew who hopes to bring roads, hospitals, and electricity to an Arab village on the West Bank. Meet Katzman, the cynical military commander of this zone in the occupied territories, who brought Yuri into his service, ostensibly to help do justice, but in fact to contaminate Yuri with Katzman's own hopelessness. Meet Shoshi, a brilliant psychotherapist, working with juvenile delinquents in Tel Aviv, who is married to Yuri and Sleeping Secretly with Katzman. These three are emblematic, talking heads, opposing ideas of truth. We could have found their like in any number of serious European novels. But now meet Helmi, the fourth storyteller here, an Arab madman, a one-eyed, humpbacked holy fool, in his cave or in the barrel where he dreams. Helmi belongs to another literature entirely, the Koran and the Arabian Nights, an epic of panthers and dervishes, of lanterns from Bethlehem and candles from Nablus, of harvest songs, locust plagues, donkeys with samovars, the English and the Turks. What Helmi, flying over his invisible village, sees through his blind eye is Palestinian history. What he hears on a transistor from Cairo and Beirut is a lamentation of the weeping, fallen, and forsaken people. To Katzman, he says, we should have kept silent. We should have drawn into ourselves. Think of it, a million people never touching you at all. Silence growing. In the beginning, you may shoot us, but we will kick a hole through our killers. This, however, is the season of blood. Helmi's own son is dead. He has taken Yuri, a holy fool like himself, as a hostage. I haven't time to explore all of Grossman's craft, his pairings and parallels of suicides and deaf mutes, his three different meanings for Rose. As well as a novel of Israel and Palestine, The Smile of the Lamb is also about languages, symbolic systems, secret communications. Hebrew and Arabic, of course, but the words of the prophets, too, and military orders, and the infant tongues of fathers and sons, the sign language of lovers, what the kites say, and the plants, and the tape recorder, and the wooden tiles in a game of Scrabble. All of these languages lie. The truth only occurs to Katzman when it's too late. Everybody in the Middle East, he says, has been turned into a hostage.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Smile of the Lamb by David Grossman. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Pat Ford, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shirok. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine political tensions between the haves and the have-nots of the Middle East with Joe Stork, the editor of Middle East Report. And psychiatric social worker Ray Scurfield tells us about the work he did in Vietnam, deciding which soldiers were psychologically unfit to return to combat. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.